WNSNP presents The Todd Ortloff Show. Now from Port Angeles, it's Todd Ortloff.
And welcome once again to the program. First part of the show today, we're actually going to talk about a couple of things, but very much related. One is PDRC, which is the Peninsula Dispute Resolution Center. I can't even recall, but Karen Brown is here, the executive director for that organization. It's been too many years, I think, since we've had Karen come on and talk about what that what her group does and what her organization does. And we also have with her Pete Peterson, who's director of juvenile services here in Clallam County, because these two organizations actually work together in a program that's called WIT, which is called We're in This Together. We've talked about this, but it's been a long time since we've chatted about that as well. But it really is a way to help youth and families get through some tough times, I guess might be a good way to put it. But we'll get into that just a bit more. So thanks both of you for coming in today. Good to see you both, Pete and Karen.
Thank you. Good to be here. Thanks,
Karen, I'm going to go over and talk with you first. Let's talk about when, you know, PDRC. Some people may know it if you get into a small claims court situation or you get into some place where they have like some sort of mediation program. That might be their only exposure they get to somebody or something involved with PDRC. But tell us what the Dispute Resolution Center really is.
So we do mediations. We do small claims, of course, as mm-hmm. you mentioned, and we also do mediations with families who are struggling with co-parenting and looking at their current parenting plan and how do they move forward in, you know, doing the best things that they can do for their children. And so we mediate those cases, and we also do workplace mediations and one of the main things that we do are trainings.
Right.
We have a 40-hour basic mediation and conflict resolution training where it's not only for individuals who want to become a certified mediator and volunteer for our agency, it is also a wonderful opportunity for individuals that want to enhance their skills, learning about not only their own, how they deal with conflict, helping other people with conflict. Mm-hmm. So business leaders, human resource directors, individuals who just want to know a little bit more about how to work through conflict in a safe way.
And Lord knows we got a lot of it going on, depending on wherever
yes,
you go. You just can't seem to be away from it. How long has a PDRC been in existence now?
It's 1992 is when they came into existence,
right.
Yes.
This is a nonprofit.
Yes.
How are you supported? I mean, I know there's some fees for services and things like that, but how do you pay to do all of this?
We do have funding that we received from court filing fees.
Right.
Through Clallam County and Jefferson County District Courts, and obviously, as you said, fees for service. We also, each DRC is a part of a bigger network, which is Resolution Washington, which is our statewide network, and we work really close with our legislators, and some of our funding comes through the state capacity funds. also, our trainings. And we also have a contract with Juvenile Services to offer the We're in This Together program and donations.
Right. How many, can you give a rough estimate? You've been there a long time. How many people do you think have gone through training, would you say, with your organization over the years?
Oh, wow. That's a really good question.
And maybe we should limit that to the official capacity. I took a class to be trained, not necessarily I was there because I was told to be there.
Mm-hmm. For the 40-hour basic mediation training, I would say we average about 12 to 15 a year.
Okay.
So that's...
Yeah. Do the math.
Yes.
There's a lot of people, though, that have actually gotten some pretty, I think, good training.
Yes.
And enlightening as well. I think it's curious, as you brought up, and I can see it. It actually is self-reflective, maybe more so than outwardly reflective for most folks, when they kind of realize, oh, wow, I'm dealing with this internally all wrong.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Because, you know, conflict is a very natural thing. We all experience it. It's how we work through it, understanding our role in the conflict, looking at the relationship and how important that relationship is. Without conflict, we wouldn't have social change.
It's true.
And we wouldn't have personal growth.
We humans hate change, though.
Yes.
That's the problem, isn't it?
This is true.
Yeah. With it, so describe for folks what, you know, because when we talk about this service, I think we tend to think of just this, you know, heinous, terrible time for things as well. You don't always deal in that situation, right?
Say that again.
Well, okay. A lot of people are upset and there's a lot of angst, but at times maybe it's not as intense perhaps as it is, but it's still considered a conflict, right?
Everyone deals with conflict differently. Yeah. When someone calls our office, you know, and they have an issue that they want to work through, we give them a space where we listen to them. You know, what are their needs? What are their interests? Helping them calm down. You know, looking forward, what would it sound like if you could say this to the other person? Preparing them to have that mindset to go forward in having a safe conversation with someone where, you know, the issue could be long term. It could be just recent. It's not always, you know, some people are in, you know, I heard about mediation. A friend of mine said it was really great and they, you know, moved through all their issues and, you know, their relationship is much better. So it's not always, you know, up in arms. Sometimes it is, I'm ready to do this.
Right. Before we leave this too, some of this is cost saving as well. I mean, the reason that there are some court mandates in some cases to come see you is that in the old days, quote unquote, before there was this, you'd be sitting there with a couple of lawyers racking up quite a bit of legal fees.
This is true. And many of our lawyers in our community, you know, really, you know, they suggest to their clients to go through mediation. It is very cost savings because they're making their own agreements. They're sitting there. It's not just about the law. It's about an individual and the relationship. So it is cost saving as far as going to court, and it's long term.
Right. All right. So let's talk a bit about WIT and what we're in this together. This is a program now, and maybe I'll turn it over to Pete, and you can kind of give us a little history as to how it got started. But 5-6 years now you've been doing this.
Yeah, about 6 years, Todd.
Okay.
Excuse me. This is. One of the programs that we started about 6 years ago in juvenile services, and with some state funding that's distributed to juvenile courts, there's several different things, kind of a buffet of things to choose from that might work in your community. So each of us do things, different programs with this money. One of the programs, which the official name is Coordination of Services, which doesn't have much of a ring to it. And that's when we started looking into this, well, what does that really mean? Coordination of services. But that's the official title. And it's one of those evidence-based programs that has been tried and true for many years in different places. And we had tried a couple of other programs and with limited success and wanted to offer something to early on first time minor offenders. These are kids that we do a risk and needs assessment on the youth that come through. So these are considered low risk instead of moderate or high risk. So it's for a lower risk youth and parents. I think, you know, any of us that, we've all been children, and most of us have been a parent, you know, and we were talking about conflict. Mm-hmm. That's a normal thing in a family life. And so these youth are, when I say minor offenders, you know, it's not anything egregious. Even though in non-legal terms, it is egregious to, you know, I think us as individuals, you know, domestic violence is an egregious, but in legal terms, you know, it's a gross misdemeanor. It's not a felony. And one of the things, so when we started talking about this program several years ago, it's like we wanted to offer something to lower risk kids that maybe weren't heavy into, you know, the criminal behavior, the drugs, the alcohol, the school issues, and all those sort of things. And I'm not even sure, something must have shown up in front of me to make the connection that, gee, PDRC, you know, we're looking at what kind of things we could do. Seemed like a perfect fit to try to put a program together to offer to parents, and I'll let Karen talk in a minute a little bit more about, you know, what they do at these specific sessions. And fortunately, they agreed, and it has worked out very well. And in fact, and I'll toot the horn for Karen and the PDRC, we weren't the first in the state, and there's probably about 8 or 9 courts, I think, maybe 10 that are doing this similar program. You can have variations. Karen's program, the WIT program, has become the gold star in the state, and she has gone to other communities to talk about how they do it, what they do. I believe we might be the only community that has the connection with the PDRC and the juvenile services as a contract, because it is a form of mediation.
Right. So
it was a perfect fit, and like I said, I can't remember 6 years ago. Something just came up, and it's like, wow, mediation.
But suffice to say, this came through a lot of the things we've talked about in the past, Pete, with reform in the juvenile justice system and things like that, and finding other ways to kind of approach some of these issues.
Yeah.
Is a good example of it.
It is, and nobody can be an expert in everything, and few of us are an expert in anything. To be blunt, mm-hmm. We like to think we are, but when you start thinking that you have all the answers or the system has all the answers, no, there's always other ways to look at it. I think this is, the whole creation of COS was not our concept, but, it was, I think, a very innovative idea of how to work with groups of parents and kids that are in early mm-hmm. legal trouble, typically conflict at home because, what parent wants their child in the juvenile justice system for committing a crime? And again, over the many years, Karen's changed some things. There's lots of volunteers that are involved in it. So all of our low-risk offenders are referred to this program.
So this is the starting point.
Every single low-risk offender is referred to this program.
All right. So, Karen, let's go back to you. Let's maybe take us through kind of how the process works then. Again, low risk offender. Give us, give some examples in some ways without, remaining. Everybody's got to stay anonymous, obviously, in this case. But what happens? How does the process work? And lead us through what a typical WIT program looks like for somebody.
So the program is a 12-hour program, okay. And it's held on Saturday and Sunday. We offer at least 6 of them a year. And the youth has to attend with a parent or connected adult in order for them to mark that off of the list of things that they are required to do if they go through diversion or probation.
So this is going to be consecutive days, though, right? So
yes.
They're giving up an entire weekend, more or less, right?
An entire weekend.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So they come in. Mm-hmm. How do you start? What happens in every case the same? How's the approach happen? Is this a group of people?
It is a group of people. Okay. We usually have an average of 12 families, so 24 people.
Okay.
Sometimes families will be, both the parents will attend. So the day starts out on Saturday morning, 9 o'clock. Everybody arrives early, to sign in and get ready. And these are, like I said, these are people that don't know each other. Some of them might know each other. So we have to bring this group together to form our own group dynamics to move through some really tough things. And in the beginning, we do an introduction. And we model all the behavior. We have volunteers who do some of the sessions, which I'll talk about that. And then other volunteers who are there that are youth that have gone through the program before that come back and volunteer. So we go through introductions, and the parents say one thing that they admire about their child, and the child says one thing that they admire about their parent.
Which might be the most difficult part of the day in some cases.
It is. And, that's what we're looking at. We're looking at how are they interacting right now,
right.
And how to help them move forward.
Are they literally on? Do you set them together? Physically put them in the room? Does that work?
We hold it at the skill center.
Okay.
And we're in the dining room area. The room is set up in a circle.
OK. Okay.
So everybody is in a circle. Parents and you sit beside each other.
Okay. And I just had some vision that, you know, you may get a case where one wants to be on one side of the room and the other arms crossed and I don't know what happens.
Oh, well, that happens.
I bet
they
it does.
Always sit together, but arms crossed, the hoodie up, the head down.
Yeah.
When the kids come in, the parents come in, I stand there and I introduce myself. They sign in. You can always tell who really doesn't want to be there and
yeah.
who's not a morning person, who's a... And, so once we go through the family introductions, you know, getting them to, they also do a group agreement, you know, how do they want to be present? How do they want to treat each other? You know, what are their goals, you know, to become a group? And then we do active listening. And this is the most powerful part of the program where we demonstrate active listening. What is active listening? How do you know if somebody's listening to you? What does it look like when somebody isn't listening to you? And then I have the parents and the teens sit together. They face each other. And then I ask the kids to get up and go sit with a different adult.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yes.
And they have to do some communication that way then.
Yes, they do. So I ask a series of questions. So I'll ask the parent a question. And the questions are based on what it was like when they were teenagers. So what was the hardest rule or boundary that you had to follow when you were a teenager? And then they tell their story to the kid. And the kid uses good active, you know, good listening skills. And then I ask the kid, you know, a question and they tell their story to the parent. And one of the questions I ask them is, you know, tell us, you know, do you feel safe and welcomed in your community? And if you do, why? And if you don't, why not? Other questions I ask the kids, you know, when trust gets broken, you know, can you repair it? And if you can, how?
Interesting. So really, you get them in a thought process.
But
really, as most of this comes down to, anybody who's been any sort of a conflict, it's all about communication.
It's
really
relationships,
I mean,
and
that's
communication.
It.
Yes.
The old line in the movie, we have a failure to communicate.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it always is.
It
right?
is.
Uh-huh. Either someone assumes something or doesn't mm-hmm. say something correctly or says what they didn't really mean mm-hmm. or somebody hears it differently than what was meant.
Exactly.
Right?
Yes.
Now, unfortunately, that leads you down a road that can get you to some big trouble later.
Exactly.
And so these types, and Pete, maybe you can better answer this. So these types, you know, when we talk about a low-risk offender, define what that might be for somebody. Because, you know, what did they do to get in trouble?
What does that mean? As I said earlier, statewide juvenile court system uses a validated screening tool that's called a risk and needs assessment. And so there's a variety of questions, and they're called in different sections. So, you know, cover things about home, about school, personal things, criminal behavior, obviously part of it, drug and alcohol use. So it's, you know, pretty much what one would think when you're looking at whether you're an adult or a child. Okay, what are my risks? What are my behaviors? What am I doing? And so typically, it's not impossible that somebody that has fairly minor charge could come out as a moderate risk, a higher risk youth,
right.
because of lots of other factors in this screening tool. But typically, the odds are if it's a misdemeanor, marijuana, minor drug charges, mm-hmm. you know, I should never say minor because the public doesn't think this stuff is minor.
Right.
But legally, they're considered minor charges. So misdemeanors, you know, some drug charges, alcohol charges, assault four is a gross misdemeanor.
Is a status offense in some ways ever get somebody into, you know, into this program in some ways where maybe they've been, you know,
that's a good lead-in question.
Yeah.
One of the things, because, you know, funding has specific things that you can sometimes spend it on and things you can't spend it on. So currently what this program has been designed for and tested on is coming into the system with a criminal act.
Got it. Okay.
So even though there, and we've talked about this a lot, Karen and I have, and staff and lots of folks, I mean, this program, regardless of whether you ever even knew where the juvenile center was at or as a kid committed a problem, I mean, this could be, you know, and it's one of the things we talked about. It could be expanded using all of the same principles for any family.
The reason I asked, I mean, I'm thinking if you've got, you know, a runaway, somebody who's, you know, right. hasn't really committed a crime, but that's a status offense. It's not right to run away when you're under 18, right? So, that might be because I think, Karen, as you mentioned, a lot of what may be prompting that youth to act out that way could be some sort of an issue with a, you know, conflict at home.
Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things we're seeing with, because, you know, with our other programs, the at-risk youth program.
Right, right.
We can't use this money, per se, for those
that.
Families.
Okay.
The truancy, you know, kids and parents, that there's conflict at school and probably at home, too, a lot of times.
Yeah, so you can't use that money. So that, okay.
But if, just recently we're talking about, if we could find a more generic funding source and could build capacity for lots of families, self-referred families, just like mediation and that sort of things, you know, if the capacity was there and the funding was there, I mean, it definitely could be applied to anybody.
All right, before we run out of too much time, I got to ask Pete, does it work? I mean, it seems like it must be doing something good.
You know, it's the does it work is always, you know, always right. like, how do you measure if it works? Well, one way is feedback. And so the feedback, and that's one of the things Karen gets in the program, is feedback from parents and from the youth involved. And it's typically very positive, very enlightening. You know, some of these families, you know, again, I have to just generically say,
right.
but, you know, because not every family, some of these families may have been the longest time that mom and kid
They've actually
or dad
interacted,
and kid
right?
yeah. have Yeah, been in a room and interacted for 6 hours straight, for 2 days in a row, for 12 hours. You know, weekend comes, kid goes this way, dad goes this way, or mom, or so, you know, long term, again, that's one of the reasons evidence-based programs get funding, is that they do research, they look at these kids, and the research shows, yes, that it does help long term. Does that mean one of these youth is never going to commit another crime? No, but there's positive influences,
right.
And that's one of the things Juvenile Services does in what we do with children, period, is to try to plant the seed and the information, hoping that it'll continue to, you know,
It's certain. I mean, even though you have justice in your type of justice, the juvenile justice level is a different kind than what we talk about in a adult system. Certainly.
Yes, yeah, justice isn't going to prison.
Yeah, right. Anyway, in about 30 seconds or so, just two things for you, Karen. It must be interesting to get that feedback you just talked about. And do you get feedback after the program from folks as well? I mean, I know part of what you do at the end of that second day is to get people to give you some, you know, feedback. But do you further follow up?
Well, I see a lot of the families out in the community, and it's amazing when I have a parent come up to me, it's going to make me cry, come up to me and say, you changed my life. Huh? You changed our family's life. My daughter is doing this now. And my kids are, you know, we approach conflict in a different way. We've changed our lifestyles based off of what you taught us at the program. I have kids that come up to me and say, you know, I'm a better person now. I know that I can only define myself, and I've made a lot of changes in my life based off of what I've learned in that program.
Hey, if it takes 12 hours of sitting people in a room and it keeps them from staying out of Pete's facility later on, I think that's a good thing, or even
that's
an adult facility later, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, Karen, how can people get in touch with you about any sort of thing with PDRC? Maybe even they have some questions about this. I'm sure you'd be happy to talk to somebody about it.
They can call our office at 360-452-8024. Our office is on Peabody Street, 319. They can stop by Monday through Thursday, or they can email me at karen@pdrc.org.
Perfect. All right. Thanks, guys, for coming in. What an enlightening program, though. You know, and it's great to see that there's kind of another option to get those youngsters on the front end of things. And their parents, too, for that matter. I think, you know, we focus on the youth, but us grown-ups need help quite a bit often, too. So, Pete Peterson, good to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you very
much. He is the director at Juvenile Services here for Clallam County. And Karen Brown is the executive director of Peninsula Dispute Resolution Center. And we're going to take a break. Be back with more in just a moment.
Olympic Peninsula title is clearly your first choice for full-time title and escrow service. But did you know that they're huge supporters of our local community and many wonderful organizations? Olympic Peninsula Title has actively been a part of sponsoring groups such as Operation Uplift, OMC, scholarship funds for Clallam County graduates, graduation parties for Port Angeles and SQIM, the Sir Optimus Noon Club, the Boys and Girls Clubs of the Olympic Peninsula, and the Lions Club. Olympic Peninsula Title, continuing to do good things in our great community.
My design group is probably the best I've ever run across.
Betty is absolutely ecstatic about the job Jack Osborne and his By Design Group team did on her bathroom remodel.
It is absolutely beautiful. I don't even know how to describe. They put in a new shower and in my bathroom. It's absolutely gorgeous. And flooring just looks so much better, and it's an absolutely gorgeous. It's kind of like my spa.
You'll enjoy your home so much more when every room is just the way you want it. And that's their specialty, By Design Group.
By Design Group, they do everything, so I don't have to go to a plumber, a painter. They take care of everything, and I would highly recommend them to anyone.
By Design Group in SQIM, your authorized Best Bath, Jacuzzi, Safe Step, and Meditub dealer. Call 582-1843 or visit them on Carlsberg Road.
I have to say, they were probably the best I've ever encountered.
Seven Cedars Casino gives you a true array of options for dining out. Enjoy weekly specials at the Totem Bar and Grill, such as Prime Rib or the Petite Surf and Turf. Enjoy stone-fired cuisine at Napoli's and try one of their many gourmet pizzas or lasagna or chicken fettuccine alfredo. This Salish Room restaurant offers a wide variety of cuisine in their incredible buffet. And if it's just a good glass of wine you're looking for, Uncorked Wine Bar is open Thursday through Sunday evenings with live music every Saturday. No matter what the occasion, Seven Cedars Casino has a dining experience you won't soon forget.
Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he will not oversee any investigations involving members of the Trump campaign and their contacts with Russian officials.
I have recused myself in the matters that deal with the Trump campaign.
Sessions making the announcement at the Justice Department a day after it confirmed he spoke with Russia's ambassador to the U.S. twice during the campaign while he was a surrogate for Mr. Trump.
Let me be clear. I never had meetings with Russian operatives or Russian intermediaries about the Trump campaign.
Says the meetings were normal in his role as a senator. This won't likely be enough for top Democrats like Chuck Schumer or Nancy Pelosi, who say he needs to resign because during his confirmation hearing, he said he didn't have communications with the Russians.
The fact that the attorney general, the top cop in our country, lied under oath to the American people is grounds for him to resign.
President Trump says he has total confidence in Sessions. Scott Goldberg, ABC News.
News Radio KONP.
This message brought to you by your Mitsubishi authorized dealer, All Weather Heating and Cooling. Mitsubishi Electric Heating and Cooling Systems offer efficient individual room control with halogen filtration, no ductwork, and dramatic energy savings. Mitsubishi Heating and Cooling Systems. Live better. Contact All Weather Heating and Cooling today.
Through the day, mostly cloudy skies and occasional rain. Today's high about 45. Mostly cloudy skies tonight, occasional showers. Lows overnight around 39 degrees. Tomorrow, skies will be cloudy. We'll see some occasional rain. Highs around 44. In the extended forecast on Saturday, showers of snow, the high 42. On Sunday, snow showers around, the high 42. And on Monday, snow showers, the highs near 42 degrees. I'm Tom Churchill for KONP.
And welcome back to the program. Going to spend the next segment talking with Jim Waddell. He's a civil engineer. Actually, he had a career with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, some 35 years in that service. And what's interesting about Jim is, and I had to remark, it's always fascinated by folks who end up retiring into our area with background on things that we talked about. And over the years, we've talked quite a bit, especially with the local utilities folks, about the Columbia and Snake River Dam system, the Bonneville Power Administration, and the controversies, quite frankly, that go with those dams, whether it is for power generation or irrigation or navigation or some other things. And Jim contacted me a couple of weeks ago after we talked with some folks from the PUD about their efforts to persuade the BPA and the federal government to continue operating the Snake River Dam specifically. Jim says, well, you know what? I was involved in a study, and many of you may remember this in 2003 when it really was making the news about The federal government was really coming down to brass tacks on what should happen with the Snake River Dams, the lower Snake River Dam specifically. And Jim was actually in on that study and going to join us now to talk a little bit about that and kind of how he's revisiting some of his research. So first of all, after saying all that, thanks for coming in. Good to see you. And let's first of all go back and talk about kind of your background at the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and with those dams. I mean, you specifically, if I understand this right, were hands-on with what was going on with those dams.
Yes, that's correct, Todd. I had a lot of jobs in the Corps of Engineers, from field assignments all the way to the headquarters in D.C., so I got my hands on everything from policy to how to do cost estimates to construction management and so forth. But I also was the deputy district engineer at Walla Walla for a few years back in 99 to 2002 when this study was going on in the late stages. And so that's where I got into it. And at that time, I had some very deep concerns about particularly the economics work and so forth. And what this report was actually saying, that, and I have the economics report right here, is that these dams aren't economically viable. Now, that's not the conclusion, though, that the Corps made. They basically said it would be devastating to the economy to breach these dams, and that simply wasn't true. And so what I've been doing over the last few years is revisiting that and trying to figure out what were my concerns, because at the time, you know, time was rushed and everything, and I just had to make a judgment, and the judgment was it wasn't very valid. But in looking into it now, it isn't just off by a few million dollars here and there, but the Corps, we made a $160 million a year mistake. And it totally changes the economic argument for these four dams. And I want to remind people that we're talking about the four dams on the Snake is the problem, not the rest of the dams on the Columbia River.
This isn't breaching the entire system that we know of in all of eastern Washington, correct? I mean, when we talk about the Columbia River dams and that.
There's a tendency to wrap all dams
that's
together.
That's right. We put them all together in that
hole. And say, oh, we want to breach them all. Well, that's not the case. What we're saying is these dams are a problem. And we need to take the money that we're spending on those dams and put it on the other dams and other energy resources. And so anyway, the economics really shows that breaching these four dams is really a good deal for Washington. It doesn't cost the state of Washington anything to breach the dams in the first place. And what we lose in jobs by not breaching is about 3,000 to 4,000 jobs per year. And I noticed that on the show the other day, the PUD guy said there was 100,000 jobs associated with dams. Well, even if he was talking about all the dams, it can't be 100,000 jobs. I estimate that it's probably at the most 5,000 or 6,000. On the Snake River dams, there's only 500 jobs associated with the shipping industry and operations of the dams. Of course, the dams are manned by federal employees, so they're protected. They get a job no matter what. And so when you get right down to it, what we're doing is that we're giving up $500 million a year in direct economic benefits just in recreation. Now, what the Corps didn't calculate is what do you get when you get 140 miles of reservoir of lakes drained and you get your river back? Well, you get what used to be there, which were vineyards and orchards. And so when you throw that back into the equation, which no one's really done much of an estimate, I've taken a crack at it, but just putting 5,000 acres of viticulture back.
I was going to say, considering the wine industry in this state, that might be worth another look at this point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Even since the late 1990s.
No one's looked at it, though. But just a rough calculation on my part is that just in leasing that land, the state of Washington would get that land, and if they leased it, they would get about $30 million a year to the Department of Natural Resources, which goes into the school budget. So there's another loss the state is incurring because of these dams. And so whether you're talking about hydropower, and oh, by the way, the Pacific Northwest has a oversupply problem with with all power. The surplus is about 18%. If you take the Snake River dams out, that surplus drops by 2%. That's all.
That's it?
That's
really?
It.
So, you know, and I know a lot of this you're trying to answer yourself again, as you just alluded to at the beginning. Why was some of this not really, you know, put out in that sense back in 2003 when these decisions were kind of made and this same study is kicked around? I mean, a lot of people may be wondering, well, with that extensive look at taking out this major infrastructure, why didn't this stuff get looked at? Or why wasn't it presented that it's only a 2% drop, for example?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, and I think people, what they do is they get caught up in what they read in the newspaper, hear somebody say, and they don't bother to look at stuff. And the thing is, we're all guilty of not reading these government documents. But everything that I'm talking about is based on government documents from the Corps, Bonneville Power Administration, or National Marine Fisheries Service. So it's all there. And I mean, right. You know, it just takes some effort to dig it out and find it.
Can we replace, I'm just assuming here, and I know you're well removed from all of this at this point, but you take those dams out. Two things come to mind. What about, you know, navigation? That's been one of the arguments, is then the river becomes not useful for getting goods and products basically out of the inland empire and out to sea. That is an issue.
Well, sort of. It's okay. So much for the inland empire that never materialized. The sad truth is navigation on the Columbia River, while that's viable up to the Tri-Cities, going from the Tri-Cities up to Lewiston is not. Yeah. And it's been losing ever since. The only thing that's coming out of there now is grain. And even farmers have realized that they can build their own unit train loaders for grain. The state of Washington has upgraded rail lines over there for shuttle trains. And so they're shifting on their own to rail.
Away from barging,
because it's cheaper. And so the economic benefits are simply not there. Basically, the navigation system is highly subsidized, what's left of it.
Okay. Let's talk about one of the bigger economic issues that you had talked with me about when we were setting this up, was that it's just maintenance on those facilities. You know, you leave those dams in, just keeping them operational is a lot of money.
Yes, it is. Right now, today, it's running a little over $200 million a year, which is more than the power revenue that's generated from it. And so when you actually put that into an economic analysis over the life of the project, what we're seeing is the taxpayers are getting 15 cents on every dollar they invest in those dams. That's a horrible benefit-cost ratio, is what we call it in the government. 15 cents on the dollar, that's all those dams are producing. And so anything with that kind of return on investment needs to be shut down immediately. And the Corps of Engineers has the prerogative to do that without going to Congress.
That's my next question, is what does it take if it comes to that? The Corps could just say, this needs to happen.
The Corps can say, we need to stop spending money on these dams. And they stabilize the dam by breaching the earthen berm around the concrete, leave the concrete there, run the channel around the dams, and you've got a free-flowing river, and you're not spending the money anymore.
What do you think some of what plays into this is, I'm going to have you do some assumption here, but this is such a big project, or it feels to be such a huge project, that there's just reluctancy to do it?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of like the elbow, oh my God, we can't breach a dam, you know, and there's this just belief out here in the Pacific Northwest that our whole livelihood depends on these dams. And what people forget is these dams were authorized by Congress to provide national economic well-being good. That's what they call the federal objective. So they're a tool to do that. Now, if that tool is not working anymore, get rid of it. And invest in another tool, i.e. the other dams or wind energy or solar energy or whatever it is, if you're talking hydropower. So, but that's the point for, you know, the taxpayers and so forth. And I think people on the North Olympic Peninsula, you know, we tend to, you know, why aren't we paying attention to this? Well, they're in eastern Washington. That's their problem. We'll let you know. Well, the thing is, these Snake River salmon runs, if they are not recovered, that's going to impact our fisheries on the coast and even indirectly in the Salish Sea. Because what you're doing is you're reducing this overall size of that pie out in the ocean that fishermen go to and marine mammals go to and birds prey on and so forth. And so without that, we're making it difficult for our own recovery efforts here on the North Olympic Peninsula. And so I think people need to realize out here, they need to get their head in this game, and they need to tell their elected officials, hey, these dams are important to our well-being too, and they need to go. And I mean, based on the economics and based on the biology.
Let's flip the equation a little bit, because you mentioned that the Columbia River dams, that system is still a viable system, if I hear you correctly, if you had some money put into it. The problem is that they're lacking resources, I think is a good way to put it. That said, you know, you look at just how this is, you take the dams out on the Snake River, if it comes to that, does it make any difference when you have, you know, dams still on the Columbia, for example?
Well, in terms of salmon, it basically is a problem of how much mortality you have on each dam. And so a salmon can make it over four dams on the Columbia River and up to the Snake, but when you add in four Snake River dams, the mortality is such that nothing, well, I won't say nothing, but very few fish are making it back to Idaho, which, oh, by the way, is this pristine environment that we don't have enough salmon getting to. And I think the other thing that, you know, the people need to realize, we keep hearing that these dams are green energy or particularly carbon-free. Mm-hmm. And while they may be carbon-free, they are not methane-free. They emit methane. Now, it's not a lot, but it's still enough to make a difference. And that's at today's temperatures. As climate change kicks in, this methane will increase. And so it's going to be a serious problem with our hydro system. So what we need to do is start taking care, you know, reducing methane wherever we can. 50,000 cubic tons is what we, how much methane is coming off the Snake River dams right now. So that needs to be put into the calculation too, which isn't at the time. It's being ignored.
It's very interesting stuff. What do you think? Is this are we going to actually seriously revisit this again, do you think, at any time soon? I mean, you're a retired guy now, and you're doing what you're doing, but what about those who are still working at the Corps?
Well, there are people in Washington, D.C. with the Corps that understand that these dams need to go. It's the regional leadership of the Corps of Engineers that's so wedded to this. It's their jobs. It's what they've been doing forever, along with, you know, the political structure here and so forth like that. So it's trying to educate people here in the Pacific Northwest and get them to realize that, like Governor Inslee, all you need to do is ask the Corps of Engineers in Washington, D.C. to take care of these dams, and they can probably get it done, and they can get it done quickly. This is something that can be done within a matter of months, not years.
Let's roll the clock back some 20 years, kind of when this first started at the, you know, this research went together. Do you think that the could have done a better job, I guess, of getting the information out to people so that they really did understand kind of what's in it? And I'm looking at this document you brought in, and quite frankly, I think most people aren't going to sit down and thumb through all of that because we're not engineers.
Right. Well, you know, there was two problems. One is that, yeah, it's a big document. So what are we doing? We're going around with briefing charts that are rather misleading.
Yeah.
And I had to show those briefings to all kind of public meetings and so forth, and I regret having to do it, but that was the marching orders at the time. But the other thing is, what surprised me was when I realized about 6 or 7 years ago that these dams, I was out of the picture, didn't have anything to do with them, and I'm over here at an LWA Science Symposium hearing people talk about Snake River dams and that they are not going to be breached because of the economic value. And I said, you didn't read the reports. If you'd read these things, and I'm really looking at, I call it the general public, but there are environmental organizations who were supposedly keeping our interest, you know, the salmon interest in line here by reading this stuff. And for some reason, they just weren't picking up on the economics. And I should also mention one other economic value to us here on the North Olympic Peninsula is we've got a population of endangered orca, the southern resident orcas, that depend on Snake River Chinook salmon for a good part of their diet or their food source. And so with those failing, there's another impact of $60 million per year on the local economy that we could lose if we lose those southern resident orcas. So when you start looking at all the impacts, we've got a stake in this game, and we need to talk to our folks, our elected officials, and get it across.
Is that document still online somewhere? Can people go and look at it?
It absolutely is.
Okay.
It's on the Walla Walla Corps of Engineers website under Library 2002 Lower Snake Feasibility Study. And this is actually an environmental impact statement, and it's still the operable environmental impact statement, and it has dam breaching in it as an option. The other options have failed. Here's another data point. The Corps spent $1 billion putting retrofits on these dams to bypass fish over the dams, and that has been a complete failure.
Yeah, I know that, and that has been reported. Yeah, it doesn't work.
It does not work. And, you know, we talk about you keep hearing record runs. Well, not on the Snake River. Every category of fish is declining on the Snake River, whether you're talking hatchery fish or wild fish. On the Snake River, they're tanking. And so that $1 billion investment by the taxpayers led to nothing. So why are we going to do that again? And you got to maintain all that stuff for another $1 billion over the next 10 or 15 years. And so the point is here is that everything we've done on those dams has failed. They never should have been built in the first place. and they're not paying off now, and it's time to, you know, all the numbers say get rid of them and get rid of them now.
All right. Interesting to talk to a guy who was fingerprints in all of that to study as well. Jim, it's great to have you in, and we'll have to have you back because it's very insightful, and knowing you got a resource right here in town that has kind of that take on things. And you're right. We think of this as a faraway place when we talk about Eastern Washington, but it does have a big, big impact here too. So thanks, Jim. Good to see you.
You bet. Thank you, Tom.
Jim Waddell there. He's retired after 35 years, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, is now a local guy here and has retired out of the Corps here and has some real interesting insight in operations, especially on those Snake River dams. And whether they really are a viable set of infrastructure there. We're going to take a break, and I got some news coming up next. Stick around.
A brighter future for you is about to get started this Saturday. No, we don't have a crystal ball. We have something a lot more powerful. Peninsula College invites you to Get Started Saturday. For new Peninsula College students, this Saturday, 10 to 2. Get Started Saturday is your one stop for all of the information and resources you'll need to become a Peninsula College student. You'll have access to all of the programs and resources you need to get started soon. You'll be able to meet with a Peninsula College advisor, create your schedule and register, apply for financial aid and more. But sign up by Thursday is required. Find out more at 417-6471, 417-6471. Get Started Saturday is all about getting you started in a new direction. Don't miss it this Saturday, 10 to 2 at Peninsula College. Call 417-6471 and be ready to get started.
Hey, at our startup, my team and I move at the speed of tech 24/7. Bottom line, I just want the news that matters. So I turn to my local radio and TV stations. I want to hear from people who live and work in my town, people I know and trust, for the best entertainment, sports, news, weather, and traffic, anytime, anywhere. I stay local. Support your local stations. Text RADIO to 52886. Furnished by the NAB and this station. Message and data rates may apply. Reply STOP to opt out.
Glad to let you know that the next History Tales by Clallam County Historical Society is coming right up. And this is a really useful one, how to preserve your family treasures. That'll be Sunday, March 5th, 2:30 p.m. at First United Methodist Church, 110 East 7th. It'll be held in the social hall as usual. Perhaps you've inherited boxes of photographs, documents, and other memorabilia that have been stashed away in shoeboxes. Many of us are guilty of throwing photos into a drawer with the idea that we'll date to identify them sometime. The quilt made by great-grandmother stuffed into a plastic bag in the back of a closet. Oh, that's so bad. The talk given by staff of Historical Society is about photographs, documents, and textiles. Simple do's and don'ts of storing, identifying, and preserving your family treasures will be shared, and a printed guide will be available by donation. History Tales, free and open to the public. For information, call Clallam County Historical Society, 452-2662.
Sunset Hardware will be at the 2017 Clallam County Home and Lifestyle Show. Come check out our booth and enter to win a $500 shopping spree. While you're at our booth, grab our new spring catalog and start planning your home improvement projects. While at the home show, sign up for our new rewards program. Start your spring savings with Sunset Hardware. Visit us at 518 Marine Drive, downtown Port Angeles, 7 days a week, or give us a call at 360-457-3369.
Do you have a minor injury or illness but can't get in to see your regular doctor? Olympic Medical Physicians Walk-In Clinic provides same-day, non-emergency services at 840 North 5th Avenue in Squim. The clinic is open Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. and Saturday and Sunday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. For more information on walk-in clinic services, visit olympicmedical.org or call 582-2930.
It's always a good time when you play at the Elwha River Casino, just west of Port Angeles. Find over 100 of your favorite slots and always fun new ways to enjoy them. Visit the Players Club booth and join for free. Members get access to parties, drawings, giveaways, and more. Surely, with all this fun, you'll work up an appetite. The River's Edge Deli might just be the best-kept secret in Port Angeles, offering a great lineup of food specials and options. Try their homemade soup or handcrafted deli sandwich piled high with Boar's Head meats, gluten-free, no problem, made to order on gluten-free bread. Follow that with a mouth-watering dessert. It's always a good time when you play and dine at the Elwha River Casino just west of Port Angeles.
Attention to all listeners of this station who suffer from any kind of pain, whether it's back pain, joint pain, arthritis pain, foot pain, or even diabetic foot pain. We have breaking news. There are changes with Medicare and insurance companies that may benefit you. These changes may now allow you to receive safe yet very powerful pain relief treatment items covered by Medicare and your insurance. Thousands of customers have been sent these proven pain relief systems that now may be available to you. With your qualification, you could receive these pain relief systems, which may be covered by Medicare and your insurance company, at little or no cost to you and include free shipping. Call now and use the special code RADIO to activate and confirm your eligibility. Call right now at 800-797-1086, 800-797-1086, 800-797-1086. Call now, 800-797-1086.
Your station for news and information. News Radio KONP, Port Angeles, Squim. FM 101.7 and AM 1450.
From ABC News,